Hi, welcome to Understory, Western Australia's only environmental radio show. I'm your host, Tom Wilson. This is the very first podcasted version of the show. Yes, Understory has finally become podcastable, so you can listen to us at your leisure on your MP3 player. Whoever called us Luddites. And by the way, thanks very much to Paper Plane Project for that cool intro theme. It's the start of spring here in the Southern Hemisphere, and I hope you're getting outside and enjoying all the flowers that are showing themselves in the bush around about now. I certainly have been. Today I'll be talking with Paul Gamblin about a gas plant on Barrow Island, and Mark O'Connor about a sustainable population for Australia. If we value some of the things that make this country different from other countries in the world, we need to protect our islands from any further human-caused impacts. In this way, we'll protect the wildlife, the landscapes that enrich us, and connect us to our past. Chevron should be happy about the recent deal for a gas plant on Barrow Island, but you, dear listener, you may have just heard the death knell for an important part of your national heritage. I asked Paul Gamblin, the director of the WA branch of WWF, about development in the northwest of Australia and what it means for our wildlife.
Minister Garris recently approved the expansion of the liquefied natural gas project proposed for Barrow Island. He did that last week, and he followed the decision that was made along similar lines by Minister Farragher a couple of months ago, where she approved it from the state's perspective. So the project has now received both the state and federal environmental approvals for an expansion from two trains to three trains, which is a sort of a 50% expansion for the project on Barrow Island.
Right, and just to give people a bit of context, this is an important place for Australian fauna, animals. Why is that so?
Well, Barrow Island is a sanctuary, really, for species like the burrowing bettong, which is this beautiful photogenic little marsupial, the only one that that lives underground in sort of rabbit-like warrens, which has been driven to extinction on the mainland. Since sort of European settlement, unfortunately. So Barrow Island is a sanctuary. It's there in good numbers. But it's really important that we protect Barrow Island so that the burrowing bettong actually has a sanctuary into the future. There are also other species like the golden bandicoot, which is near extinct on the mainland. There's the only snake that lives entirely underground, as far as we know, lives on Barrow Island. A whole lot of other species that live in caves and the little pockets of water beneath the surface of Barrow Island. There's a subspecies of bird that's not found anywhere else. There's a long list of species that are found there that aren't found anywhere else, or if they are, in a very limited number of places, like the black-flanked rock wallaby, which is just found in a few pockets around Australia, which rely on Barrow Island. So it's really important habitat, and that's why WWF has referred to it as Australia's Galapagos. We think it's that important.
And I guess islands in general are important off the Australian coast in that the mainland's been really decimated by foxes and axes and bulldozers over the last couple of hundred years. A lot of the islands are the only place that many of our original living inhabitants hang on.
They are really important refugia, and we need to do a much better job at looking after them. And Barrow Island is one of Australia's oldest and most important nature reserves. It's been a nature reserve for nearly 100 years, and it is the wrong place for massive industrial development, dredging of coral reefs, the threats to the habitat and to the species posed by this project, which is so big it'll be seen from space. It's a massive project, and it should not be built on a fragile, important island like Barrow.
But hasn't some industrial development already occurred on Barrow Island at this point?
Yeah, there's been an oil field. Oil's been extracted from Barrow Island for some decades now, and the proponents have done a reasonably good job, and we've acknowledged that, of managing some of those impacts. But there have been impacts that there already, the introduction of an ant, for example, and other things that need to be, you know, better documented in future around the management of the island. But there is also a line of argument that because there's been some oil drilling there already, that that an LNG plant wouldn't create significantly greater impacts, which is an absolute furphy. The LNG plant is vastly bigger and has impacts on the flatback turtle, for example, which the oil field ordinarily wouldn't, because it requires the construction of a major port. And this is an area which is highly diverse in terms of its coral, very healthy coral reefs, and some of those will be dredged. Large areas of coral will be dredged by massive equipment to build a shipping channel.
They're literally going to go through and smash the coral.
They're going to go through and grind the coral into a fine paste, and that paste will actually be distributed by currents across other areas of coral, which will be put under significant stress across quite a wide area.
And do you think it's likely that little rodents that are maybe hanging on here and there might jump ship once they get to a jetty on Barrow Island now and again over the coming decades?
When you've got thousands of workers, particularly during the construction phase over many years, and tens of thousands of tons of equipment being moved around, it's almost impossible to manage the quarantine system without there being significant breaches. So we're worried about feral animals and diseases being released, introduced to Barrow Island, which could have a seriously negative effect on the biodiversity.
And what does Western Australia's own Environmental Protection Authority think about this?
Well, the EPA has actually recommended against this project twice beforehand, and in its latest advice it made very clear that it didn't think this project should proceed on an A-class nature reserve. But it's been put in a very difficult position of knowing that governments have previously approved the project, and it knows that governments are hell-bent on getting this project up there. So it has recommended against it more strongly than it has for nearly anything else, as has the Conservation Commission, which is responsible for our protected areas, of course. They've recommended against it too, as have many independent scientists as well as conservation groups over many years. And yet, despite all of that, Chevron, Exxon and Shell seem determined to proceed with this project on Barrow Island, and we don't think the case has been made for them to be able to do that. We don't think they have a strong argument as to why it should proceed on Barrow Island. We think there are better alternatives on the mainland.
So doesn't the West Australian Premier's ignoring the advice of the Western Australia's Environmental Protection Authority kind of condemn him to being anti the environment?
Well, we would hope that the ministers for the environment and the premier would actually take on board the EPA's concerns. We don't think they have sufficiently in this case, and anyone looking at it could see that over the years the EPA has been really raising serious concerns about this project on Barrow Island, and you know we've seen the approval, so people can come to their own judgment as to how seriously that advice has been taken. The real frustration for us is that there is a better alternative near Onslow on the mainland, where there would still be environmental impacts, no doubt, but where the impacts could be better managed. And Chevron, you know, the driver, the operator of Gorgon, is looking to build its own project to process gas from a field called Wheatstone, which is near the Gorgon fields, near Onslow. There is no reason for Gorgon to be built on Barrow Island. It could be built, co-located with this other project near Onslow, and that would significantly reduce the environmental impacts, and governments have not been able to put up a good reason as to why that can't happen.
But clearly governments are excited about the prospect of big mining royalties.
Well, the thing is, you could actually have the royalties and the jobs. The jobs would actually be regionally based on the mainland rather than transporting people out to an island, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Tens of thousands of, or thousands of workers being transported out there over a number of years just doesn't make sense. You could actually locate them near an existing town with all the infrastructure that is already there, boost the regional economy, and still get all the royalties. We're not saying stop the project. We're saying move it to the mainland. The government has said, well, you need to, there's an opportunity to bury the CO2 from the relatively dirty Gorgon fields underneath Barrow Island. If they wanted to do that, they could still do that. You don't actually have to process the gas on Barrow Island to do that. You could process it on the mainland, strip the carbon out, pipe it to Barrow Island or another aquifer around there, or a depleted oil field, and the project could still go ahead. And the government just has not, nor has the Premier been able to explain why that couldn't happen, and nor has Shell or Chevron or Exxon been able to explain that.
Do you see any link between the recent oil spill, West Atlas oil spill, and development on Barrow Island?
Well, we're seeing a ramping up of oil and gas activity in the region, and that's why, you know, governments are very excited about it. In the Carnarvon Basin, which is where the Gorgon Gas and the Northwest Shelf Ventures are, Pluto, etc., but also the Browse Basin off the Kimberley coast, and we're seeing an increase in the cumulative impact of exploration, production of oil and gas fields and condensate, for example. So we're seeing one of the world's most important tropical marine environments being put under increasing pressure. And for example, the flatback turtle that nests in very high numbers around Barrow Island has been tracked up into the area where the oil spill is currently occurring. So there are very direct links between some of the species that are being put under pressure at Barrow Island and where the oil spill is happening, and that'll be the same for other activities. So it's really time that governments put as much effort into protecting large areas of the Northwest marine environment as they are into progressing these mega projects, and we're just not seeing that. We'd like to see an extensive network of protected areas off that region, and currently there isn't one, and we're hoping that Minister Garrett, who signalled that he may look at that, will accelerate that process, and the oil and gas industry will do the right thing and provide for and support large no-take areas where there'll be no fishing and no oil and gas activity, because that's what we need as oil and gas activities increase. It's our insurance policy, it's our safety net, and all Australians, I think, would expect that would happen.
Thank you very much, Paul Gamblin.
Really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Since the 1970s, Perth's population has basically doubled. It keeps growing at 1.6% per year. Thousands of hectares of Banksia woodland have been bulldozed to make way for detached suburban houses, and in summer, a brown haze of photochemical smog hangs over your city most days. Of course, environmental sustainability means changing the way each of us consumes and behaves, but population is also influential. Mark O'Connor is the co-author of the book Overloading Australia, and he recently spoke with Understory on the line from Canberra. Mark has been noticing some interesting advertising in the Western Australian over recent weeks. Chevron's recent advertisements in the West state that the world is growing by more than 70 million people a year. So is that a problem or a solution?
Yes, Chevron has been running full-page ads in the West Australian. In fact, I believe it spent over $200,000 just recently in WA. It's running the same ad at a much lower rate elsewhere in Australia, but it's a very interesting ad because it's an ad directly about population, and it's saying, you know, some people are worried that the world's population is growing, but to us that's not a worry, that's a wonderful challenge, and we're not worried about there being too many people for energy or resources, because human beings are themselves a resource. How wonderful. And it's surrounded by all these lovely sort of heads of, you know, people of every race and kind, all looking happy, wealthy, well-fed and so on. And Chevron Human Energy is the logo below.
Now, but you think this doesn't tell the whole story?
It's a ruin transfer to work out what that ad is really saying. Obviously, it's talking nonsense about humans being an energy source because, you know, you'd have to pedal a bike for 500 hours to put out as much energy as you'd get in 1 gallon of their product. But what are they really saying? That's the interesting issue.
So what are they really saying when you read between the lines?
I think they're saying we would more people is wonderful because we'd like to sell off oil and gas as quickly as possible. No point saving it for the future. There's profits to be made today. And in particular, we'd like Australia and particularly Western Australia to have as large a population as possible because that creates hostages for growth, people who need jobs, people who suck in imports and therefore force the government to find sources of export. And what on earth might Chevron be hoping that West Australia could be persuaded to export?
I have no idea.
No, neither have I. It's very odd that big $50 billion deal was brought through recently, whereby we're to sell off, you know, the thing that any rational country would surely be holding on to, oil and gas.
You've recently published a book, I think it was 2008 it came out, called Overloading Australia, with William J. Lyons, author of The Great Southern Land, The Taming of the Great Southern Land, and a number of other works of Australian conservation history. The book, Overloading Australia, makes the case that Australia is overloaded with people. How so?
Well, we've got close to 22 million. Now, back in 1994, the Australian Academy of Science did a very careful study to advise government on what Australia's maximum population would be, and their figure was that the maximum, not the optimum or the ideal population, which would be smaller, of course, but the maximum we could afford to let our population blow out to was 23 million, which at this rate we'll have within about 3 years. More importantly, we're currently growing at something like 1.9% a year. That's the latest figure from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which counts as near as possible every immigrant birth and death. And at that rate, which credibly has since gone up to 2% a year, at that rate you double every 35 years. In other words, we would have 44 million, a dangerously high population indeed, by 2044. And by the end of the century, you know, if no catastrophe occurred and we kept that rate of growth, we would have over 100 million, which I doubt that even the greatest optimists believe that Australia could feed or look after.
No,
so
it's a
very dangerous situation we're in.
I don't think many people would recommend a population of 100 million for the desert continent. But the increase comes mainly from immigration, is that right?
It's come 50-50 over the past 20 years, 50-50 from net migration, the surplus of immigrants over emigrants, which currently has been pushed up to a stunning 200,000 a year. And the other half has come from natural increase, which is, of course, the surplus of births over deaths. Currently, we have twice as many births as deaths in Australia. Indeed, we've had that. That's been the case for about the last 20 years. I know Peter Costello went round the country raiding the public purse to bribe people to have more births and claiming that births weren't keeping up with deaths, but he was a politician and the ipso facto a liar. And the fact is that we have a very rapid natural increase. We've got a relatively young population for a first world country, again, despite the lies that are put around by vested interests. You've only got to turn to the Australian Bureau of Statistics website to check the fact. Now, just at present, the huge increase that's come in the last few years has been mainly from immigration. So at present, it's running about 60-40.
Do you ever find that when you mention this fact that Australia is overloaded with humans, it's eating into its ability to sustainably feed and clothe its population into the future, that and that because a lot of the rate of population growth comes from immigration, that you're racist? Do you ever encounter that response?
Yeah, that was introduced essentially in the Hawke-Keating period. It was largely the work of Andrew Theophanes. I think they're up against very strong arguments at that stage coming from the Australian Conservation Foundation and others that we were destroying our biodiversity. And they decided they could trump the biodiversity argument by claiming that human diversity was more important, and even suggesting that anyone who wasn't in favour of increasingly crazy levels of immigration must be someone who thought that foreigners were inferior. Now, I don't happen to think that foreigners are inferior. I think that all humans are very much the same in morals and intelligence. We're all equally good or equally bad, depending which half of the glass you're looking at. But obviously, it was a huge and very successful distraction, and it was worked essentially, I think, by three people who pushed the racist slur very hard in public debate. And interestingly, all three have since been convicted of serious crimes that go to the heart of their credibility, which may or may not be significant. But I think, it was always a distraction and a dishonesty. The debate about immigration has never been about racism. It's been about the huge vested interests that profit by the increase in property values, house prices, the housing industry, and a whole range of industries and special interests, perception of ordinary Australians that their share of the country is continually being diminished.
And of course, even if we did stop immigration tomorrow, Australia is already incredibly multicultural and ethnically diverse, so that wouldn't stop that fact.
It's one of the most diverse countries on earth, and I think that's fine. But it's not a requirement that we make it the most diverse country in the world, particularly not if that leads us to eventually having a population that's vastly beyond what the country can sustain.
Do you then find the response among people that Surely these immigrants are going to stress ecosystems elsewhere if they don't do so in Australia. So what's the problem?
It's an interesting argument. There are two very important points to make. One is that that's not necessarily the case. The interesting area here is emissions, that the average person who moves to Australia from Britain will then move from having on average 11 tonnes of CO2 that they cause each year to 26 tonnes, which is the Australian average, and immigrants fairly rapidly, you know, conform to the average of the country they move to. If they come from China, the increase would be from about 4 tonnes to 26, and if from India, from about 2 tonnes to 26.
So do you think that the federal government has a clearly stated population policy?
Just more. No, it's just a short-term policy that in the short term, the advantages of bringing in immigrants or bribing people to have more babies is that you get very large donations from industry and other vested interests that are very much in support of this. You get advice from economists that it's a way to keep the economy moving ever faster. And basically, economists are worried because they believe the economy becomes unstable if it doesn't grow by 3% a year. And so they will very often lay down that if you can get half of that, 1.5% a year increase in the labour force, plus a 1.5% increase in productivity, which you might think of as, you know, more people driving bigger machines in the mines, you can get your 3% growth.
The uncertainty around the projections that CSIRO are making from their models.
So do you think it's likely?
It's a very rare premier who's still there in 10 years' time. And the aim is to get in when you're two or three terms in office, after which you're usually on the nose, and get out, after which you, if things do go pear-shaped, you'll always be comparing, you know, the awful situation under your successor with the wonderful progressive times when you were running the country, selling off the oil and gas and everything else as fast as you could, and claiming that that proved you were a good economic manager.
Finally, how do you think that recognition that Australia, on an environmental analysis, needs a smaller population will affect attitudes towards motherhood and property speculation?
Well, it should affect both. I think we need to realise that we do not need more people, and therefore the notion some people have that motherhood is a sort of, or parenthood, I should say, you know, is a sort of act of generosity. It's giving back to the country something for what you were given. That simply doesn't hold up. You know, we do not need more people. That's the last thing we need. We certainly need the children we do have well-mothered, well-fathered, and well-adjusted. You know, that is always going to matter. But the notion that we need large families, I don't think can be sustained. In fact, I would say it's very selfish to have a family of more than two or three. As to property values, it's this bizarre situation that you expect property values to go on to keep doubling. And people spend their whole lives paying off these enormous mortgages. The choice, you know, increasingly is, you know, live in whoop-whoop or pay through the nose. And it's primarily not the cost of housing. It's actually getting cheaper to build houses. It's the cost of land. So people are being caught in this bind. And, of course, it's all driven by increasing population. If we could, reduce population growth, you'd find housing prices would go down. And despite what's claimed by the business lobbies, this would be an enormously beneficial. After all, we don't usually celebrate when we hear that the price of milk or bread has gone up, even though there's always one section of the community that profits by it.
That's a good analogy. Well, we're running out of time, Mark, so thank you very much for being on the show. That was Mark O'Connor.
A pleasure, Tom.
Thanks for sticking with Understory, RTR's environmental radio show. As usual, I leave the final word to the nemesis of Perth's property developers, but the friend of all true conservationists, Carnaby's Black Cockatoo. See you next time.